Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, a conversation with John Meacham about his new biography of Thomas Jefferson.
I think he was a political creature, and he shared our own age's discomfort with acknowledging that he was, in fact, a member of a craft that even then seemed uncommensurate with our greatest ideals.
Pamela Paul discusses this year's winners in the Book Review's Best Illustrated competition.
In many cases, you have an illustrator working separately from the person who wrote the story, and sometimes it's a wonderful combination and it really works, and other times there's a real disconnect.
Election lessons from novelist John Updike, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. The further history marches on, the greater our founding fathers seem. And one of the most remarkable of all, maybe the most complex, maybe the most brilliant, was our third president, Thomas Jefferson, who's the subject of a new biography by John Meacham, best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize winner. The book is called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. It's reviewed on our cover by the Times' executive editor, Jill Abramson, who says that Meacham has written a highly readable biography drawing on new anecdotal material and up-to-date historiographical interpretations, satisfying both journalistic and scholarly expectation. And he has also wisely chosen to look at this great figure through a political lens. I'm delighted that John Meacham's here to talk about his book. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, Jefferson, maybe the most brilliant, certainly the most diverse in his interests and accomplishments. But you really have an argument to make about him, that this is a more political, pragmatic figure than many realize.
I think his tombstone, which listed the Declaration of Independence, the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the founding of the University of Virginia, is one of the great acts of misdirection in American history. It's the Kaiser Soze tombstone, because he was basically saying, pay attention to the ideas. Don't pay attention to what I did for 40 years, because from 1769 to 1809, he was more or less constantly in public office or contemplating public office. And so I think he was a political creature, and he shared our own age's discomfort with acknowledging that he was, in fact, a member, a practitioner of a craft that even then seemed somehow uncommensurate with our greatest ideals.
And he was really good at it.
Well, from 1800 to 1840, for 36 of those years, either Thomas Jefferson or a self-described Jeffersonian was president of the United States. It's an unmatched dynasty. Lincoln didn't do it. Jackson didn't do it. FDR didn't do it. Reagan didn't do it. He had a huge chunk of American history, political history, that for which he was totally responsible ideologically and in many ways practically. He was the first great leader of a political opposition against the Federalists, against George Washington, against Alexander Hamilton. And what I wanted to do was offer kind of a redemptive case for politics, because as you know better than anybody, there's no other way to settle these issues. We have cultural battles, but in terms of directly affecting aspiration, social mobility, equality, politics is the means by which we have to operate.
John, you point out how skilled and bold, it sounds funny to say, but a compromiser he was. And there's a great moment when you describe how he and one of his most powerful and brilliant adversaries, Alexander Hamilton, worked out a truce.
Right. Jefferson was a great writer. Notes on State of Virginia was his only book, but he had a good eye for character and detail. And he talks about running into Hamilton outside the president's house here in New York.
And this is President Washington.
President Washington. And Jefferson is Secretary of State. Hamilton and Secretary of Treasury, they were, as Jefferson said in another context, daily pitted in the cabinet like two cocks. This was not a friendly relationship by any means. And their struggles that were both personal and political. But he found Hamilton looking haggard and dejected. And he had been – Hamilton was terrified, and I use that word advisedly, really terrified that if the federal government didn't assume the state debts and from the Revolutionary War and really this, giving the central government a certain kind of economic authority and economic centrality, that the federal government itself, which was only 24 months old or so, certainly no more, could collapse.
And Jefferson ideologically was skeptical, to say the least, about this. What was his fear about – because it sounds very familiar today – about the federal government assuming these state debts?
He believed – Thomas Jefferson philosophically was a small government guy. We're not being anachronistic to say that he believed that at that point that strict construction was the means to preserve individual liberty, that all governments – whether it was monarchical or parliamentary or both, had always tended to encroach on the liberties of the people. It had just been simply the lesson of history. It was certainly the Whig interpretation of the world from which they had broken England. I mean, one of the reasons Jefferson, a well-off eldest son, British North American, one of the reasons he became a revolutionary was that he saw that the liberties of the people always gave way when governments and cabinets were totally empowered. And so he philosophically was very much against the idea of the American government becoming a powerful central force.
So now he sees Hamilton. Hamilton is trying to make this happen. Tremendously dejected, what does Jefferson do?
He convenes a dinner. James Madison has been his friend from Virginia, has been leading the battle against Hamilton in the House.
And successfully.
Quite successfully. Madison was a very quiet giant in many ways. What would later become the Republicans, the Madison-Jeffersonian crowd, was stopping the Hamiltonian program. Hamilton really believed the government was at stake. And so Jefferson – instead of being what many of his opponents and what many biographers, I think, since have thought of him as this great man of ideas and dreamy philosophical thoughts and French radicalism, all of that, he saw a way to get something that the South wanted as well as something that the more commercially mature states of the Northeast wanted, which was the South wanted the national capital. And so Jefferson holds a dinner. Everyone comes together and they basically cut a deal where the capital will go to the Potomac, the national capital, giving the South a certain prominence in the southern states, a certain prominence in the life of the nation, and the debts will be assumed, giving the commercial states something. It's a fine example of what Jefferson said in very modern language. His vernacular is fascinating to climb inside because it's as though he's the best educated guy you could ever have lunch with now, you know. And he said it is best to give or take in a system like ours, to give as well as to take. That's not to say that this is some gauzy Warren Rudman-like that the middle way is always the right way. Not saying that. And Jefferson didn't believe that. What I think his art of power was he was devoted heart and soul, body and mind, to the survival and success of democratic republicanism in the United States. He'd staked his life on it. The American Revolution to him was his life. He believed in the survival and success of that system. But he would depart from dogma on almost anything except that principle. And so as philosophical as he could be, as articulate as he could believe, he's like Churchill in the Bible. You can quote this guy on any issue brilliantly, different sides. But fundamentally, he was a politician who believed that you put together coalitions in the moment to solve the problems of the moment in order to, as he once put it, to gain the ground of liberty by inches. You didn't do it by feet or yards or miles. You did it by inches.
Our reviewer, Jill Abramson, admires your analysis of how it was Jefferson really did believe in a kind of strong nation, a strongly identified American nation, without contradicting his idea, his equal belief in a small government. She says you've kind of found a way to explain that. What What is the difference? What? And Henry Adams thought this about him too, and he saw a kind of paradox. Here's a man who comes in who's going to reduce America in every way and instead more than doubles it within Louisiana. Purchase, he's called a monarch and all the rest. How do you square the contradictions in the thinking?
Well, you don't particularly, but because politics isn't about consistent thinking. It's about conviction and national survival. And that's what Jefferson understood, I think. Alexander Hamilton had been president of the United States and had bought Louisiana outside the bounds of the Constitution, had not gone to the people for an amendment, which Jefferson did not do because he thought that Napoleon was rethinking it and might take the deal back.
Right. It was happening very quickly, really.
Oh, this is the great thing. I mean, I think there's a direct line between – Jefferson was not a particularly good wartime governor of Virginia. He had a rough period. They were invaded a couple of times. Hard to imagine if a combination of Tip O'Neill and Jesus could have done much better. But
it damaged his reputation seriously.
He
right?
lived with it for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
His wife had died. It was just an awful period in his life. The death of his wife, the failure of his wartime governorship. I believe there's a direct line between his hesitancy in reacting to the British invasion of Virginia and his seizing of the initiative in Louisiana. Because he learned that if you wait, you end up paying a steep price. And so when the deal for Louisiana comes up, he immediately begins preparing to go to the country to say, give me a constitutional amendment to double the size, as you say, of the country. Then he gets a letter saying, Napoleon's rethinking this deal. And suddenly, well, we don't need that amendment after all. And he actually says later in life, in a line that Lincoln picked up and FDR picked up and JFK picked up, that the highest duty of the executive is not necessarily to the strict line of the law, but to the survival of the country. And I think that's the line of thinking that Jefferson does not get much credit for. Partly because he was so much more articulate on the other issues you raise. He was so much better in terms of, we should all be, the little communities, Edmund Burke would have called the little platoons.
Right.
But in point of fact, he was a pragmatist who wanted to keep the compass of the conversation as close to a smaller government, a individual liberty basis, but he knew it was a compass. In my view, he was not some kind of airy philosopher.
Why did that next run of presidents come directly out of Thomas Jefferson? Why weren't they acolytes of George Washington, as close to a god as we had, or the very shrewd and sensible John Adams? Why Jefferson? Did he in some way embody the spirit of American idealism more clearly than they did, or the future, where America might be headed?
I believe that the politics of optimism is a big part of that. I also believe that you can't separate what I argue in the book is really a 50-year war from 1763 and the end of the French and Indian War through the Treaty of Ghent in 1815. The American struggle with Britain, sometimes hot, sometimes cold, can be very roughly analogized to the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. Sometimes hot, sometimes cold, but always there. It's actually kind of an easy argument to make because the British did come back. And so Jefferson was right in many ways to worry about this. We forget how provisional and how fragile all this was, this coastal republic that Jefferson strengthened by moving further west. His successors tended to be Jeffersonians as opposed to Hamiltonians for two reasons. One is Hamilton died. As I say to particularly David Brooks, our friend and your colleague who's a Hamiltonian, I like to point out that at least my guy didn't get shot in Jersey. he died in his bed in Virginia. But Hamilton died. And the Federalists had really backed the wrong horse in foreign policy because they were more pro-British. The British were interfering. We had the War of 1812. They burned the White House. It was not a great period to be more associated with the English forms of government than the French or the American, which is what the Jeffersonians were. And so to some extent, the Federalists had backed the wrong foreign policy horse. And then the Hartford Convention. You know, there was the strong secession, the first great secession movement in the United States was not Southern but New England. And the attempt to, based on the fear that the South and the West were going to grow ever stronger, in part because of the Louisiana Purchase, because of the power of the slave interest, the Federalists committed a kind of political suicide. That was John Quincy Adams's view, actually, that the faith of his own father had just turned mad. And so suddenly, in the middle of James Madison's terms, administration, the Jeffersonian way of looking at the world, as you said, future-oriented, emphasis on the people, pragmatic, and anti-British, was in fact the strongest political hand to play.
Well, it's also fascinating, and this is a book I suspect that will be very closely read following the election, just as your Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Andrew Jackson was. So thanks so much for joining us, John.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
It's John Meacham, whose new book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. This week, once again, we have our huge special children's section of the book review, many pages, edited by the great Pamela Paul. And it includes a lot of really favorites that we do annually, including the choice of the best illustrated books. Pamela's here to talk about it. Welcome, Pamela.
Hi, Sam.
Okay, so you did something really special. This is the 60th anniversary of the best illustrated awards that the Times hands out. So what did you do?
Well, I actually didn't have to do much because this award is very different from what we do at the Book Review in that it's not the editors of the Book Review who pick the winners. I select a panel, and then that panel determines which books were the best illustrated children's picture books of the year.
Okay, so instead of a group of us getting together, or you yourself going through all the books saying, here are the notable ones, who are the best illustrated. Instead, you really recruit really accomplished experts and authorities from the world of children's literature. Who were the judges this year?
That's right. Well, there's a tradition. There's always an illustrator who has previously won a Best Illustrated Book Award. And we were very lucky this year to have Chris Roschka, who actually won a Best Illustrated Award last year for his book, A Ball for Daisy, and also won the Caldecott last year for that book. And this was the first time that he judged the Best Illustrated Awards. We usually have a librarian or an academic, someone really from the world of children's literature. And this year we had Catherine Mercier, who is the chair of the graduate program in the study of children's literature at Simmons College. And then we have a literary critic, and we had one of our favorites this year, Bruce Handy, who is a deputy editor at Vanity Fair and is working on a book about reading children's literature as an adult.
Paint the picture for us a little bit. These three very busy, very accomplished people come in. What do? Just turn them loose in a room filled with all the illustrated books?
Yeah, and I give them lots of junk food. That's exactly what I do. They get to be kids for a day. And they go through hundreds of picture books that have come out. And the awards really differ from anything else that's out there, not just from what we do, but from what there is in the world of children's books. Because the Caldecott, for example, the authors and illustrators have to be based in the U.S. And with the Best Illustrated, they don't. And as a result, we often have a very global representation of illustrators among the winners. And they're also looking at the books not for the story so much, although, of course, story is important, but really for the illustration and for how the illustration works with the story that is there.
You know, one of the things I marvel at, Pamela, in the pages you edit, not only in this special, but in a week to week, and when we're doing children's books, is how skilled the reviewers are. Because you put a picture book or a chapter book for very young children, middle grade children or something, in my hands, I wouldn't even know where to begin. But someone like Bruce Handy, who I think is really a brilliant critic of children's literature, can look at a picture book and see all the elements, the interplay of story and illustration and drama and how it actually speaks to young people. It's just a remarkable gift.
I think that reviewing a picture book in many ways is more challenging than any other kind of book because you not only have to be a literary critic and really be able to talk about the story, but you have to have a fine eye for art. And it's really about judging the artwork and, again, that interplay because there are the great author illustrators, people like Maurice Sendak, for example, who both wrote the stories and illustrated them. But in many cases, you have an illustrator working separately from the person who wrote the story. And sometimes it's a wonderful combination and it really works. And other times there's a real disconnect.
Pamela, when you say separately, they don't collaborate?
Most often, no. And that's one of the jobs of the great picture book editors who are out there is that they will often get a manuscript of text. And then it is their role to try to think of who would be the best illustrator. And when you look at a picture book and you think about how much of it is in the illustration, that's an enormous job, and the illustration can differ so much that it really changes the entire book.
And does the author of the text have no say or veto power, or are there revisions and drafts, as it were, of the art as the project proceeds?
Yeah. It's edited, you know, that the illustration is edited in the same way that the text is edited. So it's a very sort of complicated process. And what I think is so interesting about best illustrated books is that you really see among the winners books where they're not necessarily the best-selling books of the year, but they are books in which, in most cases, the art is really pushing the boundaries of what is in a picture book. These are, you know, so many of the children's books that are out there are trying to become time-honored classics, and that's, you know, very understandable, but there are also a lot of very innovative illustrators working in picture books today that are trying to do something new and different with the form, and you often will see that in the choices.
And who are some of the winners this year? You choose 10, is that right?
Right.
Or the judges
The judges choose 10. And so we have winners, again, from around the world, several books in translation. There are two wordless books this year. One is called Bear Despair, and the other one is Little Bird. And again, that's another very challenging thing to do, which is to do a picture book with
No words at all.
John Klassen won this year, and he was a winner last year for what did become a bestseller, I Want My Hat Back. And this year he won for House Held Up by Trees, which was written by the poet Ted Kooser.
Former poet laureate.
Yes. One of the other winners I thought was really a great story behind the book, which is called it's called Red Knit Cap Girl. And it was written and illustrated by Naoko Stoop, who was actually discovered on Etsy, and her illustrations were admired by an editor who asked her to write this children's book.
I'm going to betray my ignorance as I do all the time. What's Etsy?
Etsy is a crafting website where people will create their little crafts and artwork and sell it. It's kind of an Amazon of sort of small crafty items.
And she was discovered there.
Yeah, and she was discovered
on
Etsy.
And she's now one of our 10 best.
Right. This is her first book.
And Pamela, because it's the 60th anniversary, you added something even more special.
Yes. We asked Eric Carle to do the front illustration for the issue. Every year, the cover is illustrated. And we thought that given that this is a big anniversary for us, that it made sense to have Eric Carle, who, of course, is one of the great living children's book author illustrators and is also the founder of the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Art, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year, to do our cover artwork. And so he did a beautiful job.
Eric Carle has been a fixture in this world for many decades. Do we have any idea how old he is?
He is in his 80s now. And he was delighted to do this because in a way it was a return home for him. He worked at the Times decades ago.
Another distinguished alumnus. Thanks a lot, Pamela.
Thank you.
This is John Williams, the book's producer at The New York Times, and I'm here with the podcast host, Sam Tannenhaus, reversing roles and putting him in the hot seat for once. Sam has an essay in our November 18th book review issue that is up online now, and in it he argues that John Updike's novel Rabbit Redux, the second in Updike's famous Rabbit quartet, remains, quote, the most illuminating and prophetic of modern political novels, though on the surface it seems not about politics at all. And so I'm here to discuss it with Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hey, John.
So what is your argument in this piece, and why do you think that it remains the most prophetic of political novels?
Well, Updike, who was not by any normal description all that interested in politics, he doesn't do policy. You know, there are no political figures in the book. There's not the last hurrah. It's not all the king's men. It's not advice and consent. It's really about middle American life, and Updike was its great laureate. And what he saw in this remarkable novel, Rabbit Redux, published in 1971 but set in 1969, was that the very familiar coalition of the Democratic Party was beginning to unravel over the issue of race. And in effect, what he gives us is a preview of what came to be called the Reagan Democrat. Harry Angstrom, the rabbit in the novel, and his father, Earl, are both linotypists in a printing press, and they're both fervent supporters of the Democratic Party. Earl is the father's a beneficiary of the New Deal and of Medicare. Harry Angstrom voted for Hubert Humphrey in 1968 and is very proud of it. But they begin to feel themselves getting displaced from what seems the center of American society.
Is it fair to say that they're social conservatives and economic liberals in today's parlance? Or?
It would be fair, except for Rabbit's actual life, what he does in the novel, which I don't describe in the piece. You know, typical Updike, what he does is to give us this set of ideas and beliefs and then to dismantle or deconstruct them from within. So Rabbit, who has racial anxieties and hates anti-war demonstrators. He says the problem comes from the Negroes plus the rich kids. Well, what happens? A hippie run away from Stonington, Connecticut, where if you've ever been there, is one of the most genteel and old line towns in the Northeast, comes to live in Rabbit's tract house along with a black militant who may also be Jesus Christ. And they come to live with him, and the household explodes in quite visceral ways. And through all of this drama, Rabbit actually begins to understand the America around him. So he's a social conservative in the sense that he doesn't like the he's a social conservative in the sense that he defends American values and ideals. He's a fervent supporter of the war in Vietnam. He thinks that the idea that America would do would get involved in a foreign war for imperialistic reasons, or that we want to dominate other races, this is truly offensive to him. Yeah. And when he defends Vietnam, he's really defending himself. So in that sense, yes, we understand the social aspect. What I might say instead, John, is he's a cultural conservative.
Right.
And that's really where our politics has been now for 40 years or so. And Updike presciently saw that.
Yeah. You say in the piece that the idioms have changed slightly, but the passions have not. And so you think, you know, the people in the swing states this year would be recognizable to Rabbit in their basic makeup. We'll get to the demographics in a bit, but in terms of the way that they live their lives and their ideas about American power and those other things, do you think much has changed?
Well, you know, in the course of working on this little piece, I got in touch with a fine journalist named John Forrester, who's at the Reading Eagle, which
The book is set in Reading, but it's called something else.
It's called Brewer, Pennsylvania, but it's actually a very meticulously observed report on the state of Reading, Pennsylvania, a Rust Belt town of some 85,000 to 90,000 people. That was its population in 1969. It's more or less its population now. And I was looking for information on voting patterns because it was striking to me that at a late point in the novel, Rabbit, Harry Angstrom, tells a policeman, "So no, I'm not a radical. I'm a conservative. I voted for Hubert Humphrey," which seems odd to us now because Humphrey was a liberal Democrat. So I got in touch with a fine journalist, John Forrester, at the Reading Eagle, which had been the paper John Updike grew up with. He's from Pennsylvania. Actually, he'd worked there as a copy boy when he was very young.
He kept clips from the paper over the years.
He kept clips, photographs. I saw them in the Harvard archive, Updike's archive, when I wrote about that. And as it happened, John Forrester, who knew Updike, also was on the staff of the Reading Eagle when Rabbit Redux is set, 1969. So he gave me all the breakdowns. And one of the remarks he made was, he said, yes, we're a Democratic city, but anybody else would call us Republicans.
Right.
And that sounds like the independents we talk about today.
Right. But he, but you're right that Obama carried Reading in both elections, both in 2008 and just this week, but for sort of different reasons than Rabbit would have recognized.
Yes. The big surprise is that Rabbit was afraid that there were, I'm quoting him, too many Negroes in Brewer or Reading. Well, in fact, according to the census material, there were about 6.6% African Americans in Reading's population in 1969. Actually very small. He just notices how they're more visible. They're more confident. They're cutting into his mm-hmm. own kind of what Updike calls the manna of the government, you know. But the big change is, and it's so much in keeping with the results of the 2012 election, is the enormous growth of Hispanics. Hispanics now compose almost 60% wow. of the population in Reading, Pennsylvania. This was a surprise to me, though not to my our colleague Elida Becker, who lives in Philadelphia. She was the one who told me, said, I think there's a large Latino population there. And of course, this was one of the big takeaways on the Tuesday results are something like 4 million more Latino voters than before. And I like to think that just as Harry Angstrom and his creator Updike embraced in the end this changing demographic, that Updike was probably amused by this one too. And there an interesting point that comes up is in 2008, only a few months before he died, John Updike came to the Times. We did our very first video interview was with John Updike after his very last novel had been what turned out to be his final novel, The Widows of Eastwick. And it was right before Election Day in 2008. So I said to him, I would ask him his own politics, but I said, who would Rabbit Angstrom vote for? And Updike said, well, in effect, I'm voting for Obama, so Rabbit has to vote for him too. And I thought, well, that's a little odd. You're a great novelist who's imagined this kind of Reagan Democrat. Well, guess what? Obama won Reading in 2008, carried it pretty well.
Yep.
Updike got it right.
But Rabbit himself voted for who?
He voted in 1988, the last election he participated in. He voted for George H.W. Bush, and he's embarrassed by it. At this point, he's a retiree in Florida, and he's part of a golfing quartet. He has three buddies, and I think they're all Jewish, but at least two of them are, and they're all Dukakis guys.
Right.
And Rabbit's embarrassed to tell them that he really voted for the older George Bush, who now looks to us like probably a more liberal president
right,
than Barack
incredibly
Obama.
Incredibly centrist.
Yeah.
Rabbit Angstrom, one of America's great swing voters. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks so much, John. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So any big shakeups following our election?
No big shakeups, but there are some new books on both sides of the list this week. On the fiction side, new at number 14, Jennifer Chavarini has a novel called The Giving Quilt. New at number 9, Karen Marie Moaning has an urban paranormal fantasy called Iced. New at number 6, Richard Paul Evans has a new novel called A Winter Dream. And new at number 2, The Sins of the Mother, a new novel by Danielle Steele.
One of our favorite podcast guests, though we did it on the phone.
Remember that name because she's going to come up again in this podcast.
Oh, I can't wait.
The nonfiction side of things, William Manchester and Paul Reed, who completed this book after Manchester's death, The Last Lion.
The Churchill biography.
Yes, exactly right.
Reaches its terminus, many pages, is that right?
Takes Churchill from World War II all the way up until his death in 1965. It's a big book and a long time coming. New at number 14 is Lost at Sea by John Ronson. He's kind of a features journalist doing human interest stories about marginal, like, fringe characters, psychics and believers in alien abduction and things like that.
This isn't Mick Ronson, the rock guy, writing a memoir. Oh, no, he's not quite old enough yet to do it.
There are still a number of old rockers on the list, yes. But before we get to them, Danielle Steele again. New at number 7 with a book, a memoir called A Gift of Hope. This is her second memoir. She wrote one about a dozen years ago when after her 19-year-old son had killed himself. She wrote a book kind of in tribute to him. And after that suicide, she took it on herself to begin helping homeless people in San Francisco.
Because that had been a cause of his or a concern of his.
Yeah, well, he had some mental health problems. Clearly, as most people who kill themselves, it turns out mental health is an issue there. And he was very dedicated to the cause of the homeless. He would often bring them food, buy cigarettes for them. She was always kind of taken aback by that. She said that she was always afraid to be approached by homeless people or anyone who is unusual looking. After her son killed himself and her marriage broke up in the wake of that suicide, she was pretty distraught, wondering what she could do to help people less fortunate than her. She thought, who has it worse than I do? Well, the homeless do. So she started a program called Yo Angel, where she would kind of anonymously, incognito, go out once a month in a van at midnight and pass out sleeping bags and toiletries and food to homeless people. She started it as like an outreach program and built it up into an organization. She did it very quietly, not looking for recognition for several years. Finally, about 4 years ago, she wrote an essay about it for Newsweek magazine and now has turned that into this book as a way to call attention to the plight of the homeless.
Well, good for her.
Yeah. There are just two more books new to the list this week. At number 6, The Generals by Thomas E. Ricks, which is a history of American generals from World War II all the way up to the present. And at number 4, one of those old rockers we were talking about. There's a biography of Bruce Springsteen by Peter Ames Carlin. It's just called Bruce. That joins Rod Stewart's autobiography and Pete Townsend's autobiography and Neil Young's autobiography, all on the list this week.
Well, I heard that someone in the Republican Party, I think it was one of their kind of organizational leaders, Tom Davis, said they need to create a new alignment because they're just aren't enough middle-aged white guys to go around. Yeah, they're all on the bestseller list.
Well, Bruce is not on their side.
No, he's not.
As we know, he campaigned heavily for Obama. There is, in fact, an argument making the rounds that Chris Christie's desire to meet Bruce Springsteen may have swung the election, that because Bruce was campaigning for Obama, that may have influenced Christie's late embrace of Obama after the storm in a show of bipartisanship.
But yeah, Christie's a huge, as it were, Springsteen fan.
That's right.
And Obama brought them together.
That's right.
So we can heal our partisan differences.
It remains to be seen, Sam.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.